This is MSCI Perspectives, bringing to light insights and analysis that help global investors tackle today's challenges. I'm your host, Adam Bass, and today is June 20th, 2024. On this episode, whatever your feelings about the Inflation Reduction Act, it is inarguable that the law provides some of the largest incentives for a shift to clean energy that the U.S. has ever seen. MSCI's own Matthew Lee from the Climate Research Team recently teamed up with the Rocky Mountain Institute to investigate the effects of the IRA on U.S. utilities in particular. For those who may not be familiar, the Rocky Mountain Institute, or RMI, is an independent, nonpartisan nonprofit that, as they put it, transforms global energy systems through market-driven solutions. I had the chance to speak with Matthew, as well as two of his partners at RMI. We talked about the findings from their research, as well as some of the background and context that did not make it into their published work. Here's that conversation. So as you all know, we're here today to talk about the IRA, the Inflation Reduction Act, and the impact that it's had from a climate perspective, from a utilities perspective, more specifically. So before we dive into the impact, let's talk about the IRA itself. And I'll throw this out to any of you. What do we need to know about the IRA before we get started?
So Uday Vedadrajan here. I'm a senior principal at RMI. The IRA passed a couple of years ago. And I think the most important point to make about the IRA is that really transformed the way in which the most important set of incentives in the United States that we've used to really incentivize clean energy worked for utilities. And the short of it is that before the IRA passed, those incentives just didn't work for utility. Regulated utilities in particular barely owned any clean energy, and it really didn't work with their business models and their regulatory model to own clean energy. After the passage of some significant targeted changes in the way that IRA works for regulated utilities, in particular, the way that they are able to take advantage of tax incentives to reduce costs for their customers, to monetize them more efficiently, it has become far more attractive for utilities to use tax incentives and therefore more attractive for them to own clean energy. And if there's one thing I would flag, that probably set of changes is perhaps the biggest shift in the way that utilities are starting to think about clean energy that the IRA precipitated. And I think beyond that, there are also a number of really interesting financial incentives that are targeted at utilities that are also potentially starting to shift the way that they're thinking about ownership of clean energy writ large. And one of them I'll flag is a loan program, the Energy Infrastructure Reinvestment Program at DOE, that is also making it a lot easier, particularly for fossil-intensive utilities, to dive in to taking their existing assets and starting to find ways to cost-effectively use low-cost government financing to enable the transition to cleaner resources.
Yeah, I was going to say two points that stand out to me from that overview are A, the direct transfer of these tax credits that can happen, right? So it's essentially a way for the companies that are capturing the tax credit to be able to sell it and let any other company out there, it doesn't have to be an energy company, access or gain that tax equity there. And what we've seen is a lot of companies, and most notably, as the Financial Times picked up, Taylor Swift's film production company is even getting in on this for the tax credits and reducing their tax burden, right? So it opens up the playing field beyond just utilities of who can get involved financially.
Sorry to interrupt the discussion so soon, but for reference, as the voices of our panelists continue, that self-proclaimed Swiftie is Matthew Lee, whom I mentioned at the top of the program. Now back to the conversation.
I also want to bring up again Uday's point that there are multiple incentives structured in to stack against outcomes that help transition from existing fossil communities, communities that are affected by fossil fuels. There's just transition specific incentives or again, tax credits related to if it's currently a fossil fuel plant and you are able to show a plan to transition it away, the sort of brown to green transition, there are very specific carve outs for that. So I think it's quite significant that they're aligning an outcome with a financial incentive in multiple cases.
Hey, this is John Ray. I'm a senior associate at RMI. I would also add in, we're talking about the direct impacts on electric utilities, but we also see a lot of indirect ones where the Inflation Reduction Act has also changed the other sectors that interact with electricity. So it's really making a big change in accelerating adoption of electric vehicles, of electrifying buildings, of transforming our manufacturing around the U.S. And so all of those have really big impacts also on what services that the utilities actually need to provide. And so it's changing the load quantity and also shapes. So that's a really big impact on the electric utility sector as well.
That's right. And building, I think, on what John's saying, it really is creating an enormous opportunity both on the demand and the supply side for utilities to invest their capital in a way that can be productive and lead to real meaningful opportunities for them to play an important role in unleashing what I think are a couple of the biggest trends that we're seeing in the economy today, which is number one, a reshoring of manufacturing across the country, which is being driven also in part by policy, both the combination of the CHIPS Act, the bipartisan infrastructure law, and the IRA incentives themselves are creating an opportunity for bringing back not only clean energy manufacturing across the country, but also, of course, semiconductor manufacturing, and also starting to drive, as John was saying, demand for electrification, for electric vehicles in this sector. And the utilities are in a unique position where they have the opportunity to really be the vehicle that delivers the fundamental power that's needed to drive all of this economic activity. And not only that, if you look at the entities, largely the corporate entities that are driving a lot of that load, most of them often have either clean energy mandates or are tied to clean energy. So there's a lot of opportunity and a virtuous cycle, really, that might be possible from utilities taking advantage of this opportunity to deliver clean electricity with a significant and meaningful potential growing load opportunity coming before them.
And I think that's key, too, because there is a lot of discussion around potential repeal of the Inflation Reduction Act. And because there's all these other businesses and investments that are being made as a result of the IRA, some numbers pin this companies that have put in $74 billion into red states, right, since the IRA, in terms of manufacturing as well as the clean energy projects. These are sides to me that may not be as much of a clear-cut case or priority, even if there was a change in administrations. We've heard from CEOs at NextEra communicating this. We've even heard ExxonMobil's CEO say he supports parts of the IRA, as well as the American Petroleum Institute. So these perhaps are signs that the Inflation Reduction Act wholly being repealed in its entirety wouldn't be something supported across the businesses. So many businesses are seeing financial opportunities from this. And I think on a more practical or policy angle here, let's recall that it would probably need both Congress and the presidency in control to execute something like a full repeal. And so I think for investors thinking about the likelihood of that, they'll want to build that into their consideration. And a good analogy that comes to mind is the Affordable Care Act, right? So it was a top line message we heard during election season as a priority. It was a rallying cry politically. But when it came to executing something like that, because different states and different representatives knew about or heard about their respective constituents and their respective states, how they would be impacted, they may not have voted as passionately as the rhetoric during the election season.
Now, besides the likelihood or unlikelihood of that, Matt, that's interesting. And the ACA is a great analogy, like you said. But from an investor standpoint, from the company standpoint, let's take complete removal off the table, right? If it gets chipped away at a little bit, it sounds like from what you're all saying, that there may be enough momentum that it keeps moving forward, or I don't know, walk me through what you think might be the impact.
So we've already seen some signaling of where the cuts might come. So they might target specific incentives around electric vehicles. I think that has drawn, we've seen some specific citations as a target. Part of priorities maybe to cut back on. But I think the key here is that funds that are already dispersed are unlikely to be taken back. And also removing subsidies in general is a pretty unpopular move for Congress to take. In terms of the investments already made too, I think there's a lot of, not a lot, but let's say there's quite a few cases of foreign investment and factories being built off of the momentum of the IRA. Enel announced the $1 billion solar plant in Oklahoma, Hanwha Solutions, Qcells, $2.5 billion in Georgia, LG, $5.5 billion battery factory in Arizona. These are not small amounts, right? And these are very influential business outcomes in these states. So there may be certain parts of the IRA that draw targeting, but I think more broadly, the money has already started being dispersed. And so slowing down that momentum when people have skin in the game can be a bit harder.
I can add to that point, Matthew, because I think that as we're looking at utility integrated resource plans across the country, one of the things that we're seeing is an enormous uptick over the last couple of years in the planned deployment of clean energy, with on the order of, and I'll let John give you the numbers, but tens and really on the order of 100 gigawatts of new clean energy being announced since the passage of IRA. A whole lot of that deployment is by fossil heavy utilities in red and purple states. And the political challenge here is significant to really peel again. Any kind of really significant shift that eliminates some of these incentives would mean a lot of utilities having to explain how they have to make electricity much more costly or peel back their plans to use that money to reduce customer costs on a forward-looking basis in their utility plans. John?
Yeah, I would love to provide some good numbers here. Maybe the first perspective that I would give actually is still just to reiterate that the electricity is a growing industry, and the IRA already had a big impact on that and is accelerating it and going to make that growth even more significant and sooner. But it was already the case that we knew that the size of the electricity sector was going to massively increase. This is a story we've been telling for a couple of years now and is now really picking up traction, that the electricity sector had this really big problem to meet decarbonization goals, that it was going to try to reduce emissions by 80% while simultaneously doubling the size of the grid over the next 10 to 15 years. And that second point of doubling the size of the electric grid is just a really mind-boggling concept, that we need to take the existing system and build another same size system on top of it. And we hadn't really seen that in our projections originally. So we've been doing a lot of work as part of the RMI's Engage and Act platform, where we're collecting all of the capacity plans, the resource plans from all electric utilities in the US, and seeing what their load growth expectations are and how they're planning to build and retire power plants in order to meet that load. But the renewable additions to meet it was already increasing before IRA passed. But as soon as IRA passed, definitely we saw that explode and an uptick even more. So the numbers that I have are, when IRA passed in August of 2022, the projected renewable additions of wind and solar by 2035 was 230 gigawatts across all resource plans in the U.S. And then in our most recent monthly update, that was well over 300 gigawatts. And so we've seen that increase by 35% already, even though not even every utility has submitted a new resource plan in that time frame. And so definitely really changed the landscape, really different ambition being shown in terms of really big growth in wind and solar from all these utilities.
If I could, I just wanted to add to Matthew your point, particularly comparing this to the Affordable Care Act. And I want to talk about utility risk. And right now, the biggest risk that utilities face across the country is one around affordability. There are prices going up for a lot of different reasons, whether it's wildfire risk or, you know, fuel price volatility because of geopolitics, and of course, because of essentially trying to build out all of the new load and supply needed, or rather the new infrastructure needed to meet new load. And, you know, we cannot discount the extent to which the Inflation Reduction Act creates incentives that are targeted in a technology neutral way, which is one of the other really important features that are from a political sustainability of the incentives that are in place, particularly on a forward-looking basis for the clean energy sector. A technology neutral way provide support that can bring down electricity prices by reducing the cost of the choice to use what is already increasingly cost-effective clean energy across the country by utilities. And that can be a serious and significant risk mitigant for a lot of utilities as they're going into rate cases and planning cases to be able to show how they're going to actually plan to mitigate this increasingly worrisome burden associated with affordability of electricity across the country.
Yeah, to circle back to the blog we wrote using RMI's Engagement Act data, what was pretty fascinating to me was to see that even by 2030, if you sum together all the zero carbon or low carbon resources planned, we would have more from the investor-owned utilities and low carbon installed capacity than natural gas. And 2030 now it's less than 6 years away, right? So that was a pretty surprising finding for me. And even looking at the by technology breakdown, wind growing fivefold in capacity, solar still growing by 2.5 times, battery storage by 9 to 10 times. That to me was a great example of what the certainty around IRA introducing can bring in terms of the investment potential horizon on these technologies. So it was really cool to see that play out through the IRP data that RMI has put together. And I think it, for investors looking on the U.S. outlook, it provides a lot of helpful insights in the medium term.
Yeah, we at RMI definitely love our data and charts. And, you know, when you see one line crossing above another, that's a pretty exciting point to call out. So it definitely stood out, and it was really, really interesting to see that, yeah, that wind and solar capacity is about to exceed fossil capacity, and this energy transition is happening.
I do want to throw a question to RMI's way around, let's say, concerns around AI creating more energy demand, and therefore perhaps that justifies or increases the business case to use thermal resources that in theory won't be as intermittent, right? So maybe we still need a substantial or otherwise significant amount of coal and gas if we are to meet this increased load. Yeah, I would love to get your thoughts on, you know, where that comes into play in terms of resource planning for utilities now that AI is going to drive up energy demand for data centers.
Yeah, maybe I can give a little bit of the table setting background context, and then RMI has been doing a lot of work and coming up with solutions to this as well. But I'll say definitely we're seeing that obviously data center load and AI using those data centers is the hot topic right now, and it's where a lot of the attention is being paid. And so even though we've been telling the story of load growth from electrification of vehicles and buildings and manufacturing over the last couple of years, the urgency in what's happening right now is this additional load right on top of it. And it's coming on really quickly and really fast. And so we're seeing really wide regional variation in where that data center load is happening. And so, you know, Dominion, Virginia, really huge example of so much load growth happening from AI data centers. But we also still have companies whose resource plans project contraction, actually, because they have, you know, load defection either to community choice aggregators in California or just population changes happening. And so it's not happening everywhere around the U.S., but certainly is being commented on more commonly and regionally growing.
Yeah, we are indeed seeing a significant shift in utility resource plans associated and in response to load growth. What we've seen is since the IRA passed and over the last year or so, a very significant increase in the in resource plans and the total gas capacity that folks are bringing on. This is concentrated in places like in the Southeast and in the West. So we're definitely seeing a response in some of the Southeastern regulated utilities in particular. I will flag that our team has been asking the question, well, what can you do to avoid some of these increases in gas capacity? And just to be clear, it's important to ask the question. I think utilities are starting to ask the question, and we're starting to see this emerge in their plans as well to some degree, which is, what is it that their customers are actually looking for that are driving this load growth? And as we mentioned earlier, it's data center load, it's manufacturing load, it's electrification load. And many of the corporates, in fact, virtually all of them demanding this additional load, have ESG targets or sustainability targets or renewable targets, and they face at the least headline risk, if not sort of pressure from their investors around seeing that load effectively met by increased fossil generation and certainly not coal. And so there is really a push on the customer side, we believe, to really make sure that this load is met by clean energy. And we believe there are indeed some cost-effective ways to do this. Now, there are some barriers. And one of the barriers that we've seen that's meeting this immediate need for load growth a little bit more challenging than it should be is the fact that across the country right now, we've got tons of plans for clean energy, 2.6 terawatts, 2,600 gigawatts of clean energy planned in queues, interconnection queues across the country, that are waiting 5 to 7 years, unfortunately, to get the approval to connect to the grid. So we need some solutions to move that forward if we're going to address this with clean energy. And that's one of the reasons utilities and other parties have been concerned about meeting the load growth. Now, that doesn't necessarily make it easier to meet that with gas. We haven't been building particularly much gas, and there's much less gas in the queue as well. So it's not obvious that this gas is going to help us in the very near term. But it is true that you need not just the energy, but you need the capacity. You need what is effectively long-term reliable power. And getting to grid reliability does mean doing more than just building solar, wind, and storage. You do need to think carefully about how you coordinate that, how you bring in firm resources. But there are strategies to address this as well. So I think in particular, there are some strategies that we like to refer to as making the most of the grid you've got, using virtual power plants to facilitate responsive demand, deploying a strategy we call clean repowering, which is reusing fossil interconnection or rights or hybridizing existing fossil plants to build the clean energy more rapidly than that, to sort of reduce that 5 to 6 year wait in interconnecting to make it a year so that you can build quickly and maybe even build that load at the same point so that you avoid both the challenge interconnecting load, which is really becoming a problem for AI companies. They can't get utilities to give them the interconnections they're looking for in some service territories. And so if you're able to build both clean energy and supply quickly by putting them behind an existing fossil point of interconnection, that might be a real solution to both of these challenges. And moreover, there's been a great LPNL study that shows that just replacing only the wires in transmission assets across the country could double the capacity of the physical grid to interconnect clean energy. So these are the types of solutions, including that can be used to really bring clean energy into the mix, but still enable the system to have the capacity it needs to reliably meet that load with resources that don't require heroic assumptions about where nuclear might be in the 2030s.
Uday, if you could just give a quick 1 minute primer on a virtual power plant for our listeners. What is it? What forms can it look like?
Yeah, my apologies. A virtual power plant is the best way to describe it is that it is aggregating a set of often demand side resources, whether they're batteries or responsive demand or solar units that are deployed or things like thermostats. You can pull together a lot of flexible resources that are owned by third parties, not by utilities, but together can act a lot like a plant. They can reduce what is effectively the load that needs to be met by the rest of the system and act in many ways and be dispatched in times of need, many ways in the same way that a power plant can be ramped up, a virtual power plant can be ramped up to reduce demand. And so we think that this virtual power plants are starting to become a very attractive way to meet peak demand without necessarily having to build dirty, offer or rely on old, often very dirty gas and coal facilities, often in urban or populated areas with negative impacts on local communities.
Yeah, I do love the concept that we're repeating right now, that we should be making the most of the grid that we've got. We wouldn't be RMI if we weren't focusing on energy efficiency as step one of creating the most effective energy system that we can. And so that's actually one thing that I'm curious about with data center load is that as algorithms become more and more efficient, then it's possible that projected demand from AI could actually be lower than maybe people are worried about right now. So I am curious to see how much improvements we can make there, because there are plenty of other instances where we've improved efficiency of entire systems by orders of magnitude over years. And so will that be able to happen with data centers as well? But regardless, back to Uday's list of solutions there, we've got energy efficiency first, then making the most of the wires that exist on our system, reconductoring or grid enhancing technologies, and then going to the virtual power plants, the supply side resources, and then our final one that I think is a great report that any listeners should be interested in looking at for is clean repowering that we've recently republished a report on. All of the solutions definitely make it possible to meet this growing role of the electricity sector without necessarily needing gas plants. I think one other piece of analysis that sticks out to me that we've worked on at RMI was some analysis of the EPA proposed carbon standards, where gas plants would either be required to install CCS or hydrogen if they're running at higher capacity factors. But when we reviewed the proposed rule and looked at how much of the gas system in the US was going to be affected, we were actually surprised by the result being quite low. Most gas plants and the role of gas that we were expecting to see based on review of a bunch of external models as well as our own was showing that gas plants are likely to run at low capacity factors in the future. And if you're going to build a full gas plant and not be running it very often, then that really begs an affordability question of, is that the most cost-effective way in order to meet that peak demand? If it's only going to run for 5 or 10% of the year, maybe we can solve that problem with demand-side resources or with energy efficiency or, you know, making the most of the grid that we already have.
And I think that's an important nuance for the sort of stranded asset risk people put on coal and gas, right? So if there's still a use case for it, maybe that's a way for it to stay as part of the grid. And we saw this in the block too, where you had an increase in installed capacity planned for natural gas, but the percent in generation was going to fall at the same time. And quite a few utilities, we saw that in the planning. But of course, if they're in that direction, then the considerations, John, you just raised, I think are very relevant of how exactly does the financial case change if the new gas is really only being used as a peaker plant.
I do want to move us on, if I can, to investors here, because that, of course, is our focus, our main audience, as fascinating, frankly, as this conversation is. So in this context, how are investors taking all of this in, and how should they, I guess, what should they be thinking about when they're looking at, from what you're saying, not only utilities, but all of the other sectors that are being affected by this load growth and how utilities respond to it?
Yeah, actually, if we could, I'd love to hear RMI's take on, you know, the solution set you guys just proposed, right? From energy efficiency all the way with grid infrastructure improvements, what would be some signals investors can look for, or where should they go digging to see that this has the certainty or the prospects like an IRA introducing that to their investment case?
Yeah, maybe I'll start with a couple of maybe higher, just backing up a little bit at a higher level. You know, I will flag that utilities over the last several years, until I think very recently, particularly utility equities, I think have somewhat significantly underperformed the market. until fairly recently. And I would argue that what we're seeing in the AI space in particular, but similarly with the reshoring of manufacturing, presents just on the face of it an extraordinarily interesting potential value opportunity for investors. And the reason for that is that virtually all of the economic activity, and I think the most interesting and exciting economic activity that we're seeing emerging, is contingent on being able to access power, not just power, but clean power. And that there is significant value right now to be had in identifying opportunities to rapidly and quickly bring clean power online. And if you as an investor are thinking about where to come into this space, I think it's really a good idea to pay attention to where there's load growth and ask, where are the utilities, developers, potentially demand side resources that are well correlated with where that load growth might be coming and where there are opportunities to potentially deploy clean energy. Matthew, as you said, we've got a number of strategies, and each of them suggests potentially ways to target that. And I think, you know, that's something that our data can help a little bit with, in that you can start to see where there are resource plans that, for example, are suggesting some of these, this load starting to emerge, and where there are some clean energy opportunities on the development side as well as on the utility side emerging, and which utilities are starting to really embrace this. And just in terms of sort of the technologies and where you look for each of the types of technologies, clean repowering, I would urge you to take a look at our report. We're identifying where we think that this is probably the most attractive and where that clean energy connecting to existing fossil points of internet connection could be most interesting. Some of those are in regulated markets, but a lot of those are in organized markets or deregulated markets where there could be an acquisition opportunity. And even some of the utilities themselves are acquisition opportunity. I'll point out recently a partnership between CPP, IB, and Global Infrastructure Partners to acquire and take private Elite, the Minnesota utility, which, again, has a phenomenal opportunity to deploy clean energy.
Uday, I'm sorry, not to interrupt. Can you define some of those acronyms you just mentioned?
Oh, sure. So this is the Canadian Pension Fund and the Global Infrastructure Partners. And this is an opportunity to acquire Minnesota utility, Minnesota Power, that happens to also supply the majority of what is called taconite production in the United States, which ultimately, if powered by clean electricity, could lead to clean steel that's domestically manufactured, which, by the way, also has higher incentives tied to it. So there are these particular stories that are emerging where there are opportunities to deploy clean energy that is linked to whether it's data center growth and AI growth or manufacturing growth that has incentives that are tied to it as well, that can create a virtuous cycle for economic development in those areas that can draw in, for example, also state economic development funds and the like, and also provide what is effectively a competitive product with a significant market in the United States. And I think these are the types of opportunities that are really interesting. Reconductoring and Getzer, another one. How do you actually, you know, again, as an investor, looking for those opportunities in both organized markets and in utilities can be a really attractive thing to do. I'll take an example in independent power producer world or in places where there aren't regulated utilities. There are independent power producers who own assets and can buy and sell these assets. Well, our clean repowering work shows that there are a lot of independent power producers out there who could build clean energy and use their points of interconnection to deploy it to deliver power to data centers and to manufacturing facilities, but maybe don't have necessarily the expertise to do so. So these are fantastic candidates, for example, for either engagement by investors to bring them the right capacity or for an M&A opportunity. And so again, that's the type of thing that we're really excited about. We see very significant opportunity. The clean repowering itself is about a $350 billion opportunity, 250 gigawatts.
And to go off of Uday's point on load growth being a starting point, maybe to identify the opportunity, it really speaks a lot to our framework here in MSCI world, where we like to say exposure to opportunities, right? What's your exposure filter? And for us, we're very familiar with that on our ESG ratings side, where we take geography and we use that as actually a multiplier when we calculate the exposure of a company based on their business line to different types of opportunities, whether it's clean technology, renewable energy, and our opportunity set of key issues. So to take a step back, though, in terms of companies and what does a leader look like to an investor, I think we tend to have two hypotheses. The first hypothesis is who's the first mover? And that is very relevant in the utility space and the energy space because these are very large and complex projects, because you need very specific regulatory awareness, you need to have familiarity with the permitting. If you already have that business up and running, if you're already generating revenue from it, which is a metric we like to look at, not just existing revenue from renewables, but also the time series, how much is that business growing already? Is it from 1% to 10% in the last 2 years? Or how quickly has the business been growing? There's also the second bucket, which we call ambitious followers. And here, the investment question we ask is, what are the credible signals this company has shown that indicates they will center this as a part of their strategy and they're serious in investing in it? So the first level still goes back to a bit more of a regulation point. So are they operating in a service area where, say, the state regulator has already said, you have to do this, right? Or we know that they're tapped into certain subsidies and incentives very directly. In the other case, there might be some disclosures to state regulators that we can take advantage of, which was the IRP data set for the blog, where that was a filing that, because it was part of a dialogue with the state regulator of eventually what they get approved as their revenue, that has a higher level of credibility to us than just, say, a generic statement about their sustainability goals and intentions. So communicating that in a strategy document that has some legal bearing to it, we saw that as a pretty high quality of information for investors to examine. Company investment plans and capital expenditure, of course, that's another great forward-looking metric to see the distribution of where they're going to be putting their money at. But the absolute amount sometimes can also be very significant too. A soundbite I like to throw out there is Total Energies, which the French, large oil and gas company, they do have one of the largest solar pipelines in the US. And that's because even if solar is about 13 to 16% of their total revenue right now, every year, because they are such a large company, that does translate to a significant market effect, even in a major market like the US. And then under that layer, we would have targets. And ideally, we're looking for interim targets. We're looking at specific targets company disclosed per business line. So the more you can say, this is in the next 5 years what we want to do. Some utilities have even started dividing it out by business line, saying this is our plan for our gas business. We view that as much more of a higher quality disclosure, again, than a generic net zero by 2050 commitment. So that's how we think about evaluating companies and leaders. But I know there was a good point brought up about CPPIB. And I think that's also very relevant in terms of what private markets have as a role to play in driving this. Our research from last year has identified that a lot of asset owners, in addition to the Canadian Pension Plan Investment Board, OMERS, so Ontario Pension Fund, they're also a top holder in terms of solar capacity in their pipeline. And in the US here, we have developers like Hecate and Invergy that operate a lot of renewables projects, and mostly in the unregulated space. And they are often the ones working with the industrial and the tech companies with the power purchase agreement. So there's definitely a big role to play there, and metrics for investors to look at in terms of their forward-looking pipeline and how that compares to what they're currently operating to identify them.
We definitely agree that the best information that investors should be looking at for assessing utilities is the forward-looking plans. And we love resource plans because they are approved by state regulators. And so they go through this whole process of review. And it really is like a fully drawn out plan. This is exactly the plans that they're going to build and retire. And that's really what they're planning to do. And those forward-looking projections are a much better assessment of whether or not they're a leader or a laggard in the space, whether there's a growth opportunity, whether or not they're climate aligned, is based on what their future plans are. And full agreement that a net zero by 2050 target is nowhere near as good as a 2030 target, which is also nowhere near as good as a plan to really what impacts climate is the total amount of carbon we put into the atmosphere. And so if you want to see whether a utility is making the most climate action, then you should add up all of its cumulative emissions over the next 10 to 15 years over a relevant time frame. And that's really the metric that we look at the most to see which companies are leading and lagging in terms of meeting the need of this time.
One interesting aspect that you've all brought up a few times now, so I want to ask something about it, is the role of pension funds being managed in Canada or foreign firms opening up plants in the U.S., but the role of non-U.S. players. So I guess two questions here. One is how vital is that to coming up with these solutions in a practical term, but also larger thinking as we go to reduce that total carbon emissions that you're talking about, John. Are there lessons to be learned from those in Europe or elsewhere in terms of addressing? Because they're facing the same problems, right?
I'm going to point back to some changes in the Inflation Reduction Act that make it a little easier for some foreign firms to engage. And I'll point to the tax transferability opportunity in that market. For foreign firms now, one of the options that's now available to them is to indeed engage in the U.S. marketplace, but work with firms with significant U.S. tax capacity, or if they have it themselves, to really make sure that they're able to fully deploy the tax incentives and be market participants to drive and deploy both clean energy manufacturing as well as clean electricity generation itself in these markets. The second point I'll make is that there are nascent industries in the United States that are very much dependent on capabilities that still lie on other shores. And I'll point to U.S. offshore wind as a particular area where this is important. And clearly, some of the manufacturing capabilities that we've been talking about, it is indeed the lowest cost manufacturing capabilities that we've seen, both in cell and in module, battery EV cell manufacturing, and as well as in cell and module manufacturing for PV. Are largely firms that previously would have built capacity either in China or Southeast Asia, somewhere else. I should note that this is being made a little bit more complicated by some shifts in the market. I think the very, very low cost of battery manufacturing right now in China and some of the challenges around the level of incentive that's provided in the United States may not mean that this is obviously going to translate to U.S. deployment of all of that manufacturing capability without some work and some thinking and some deeper engagement. But I think the opportunity is enormous for a lot of companies to start meaningfully investing in the United States. And that's something that I think we're seeing happening, and that capability and know-how is going to be critical for this country to have a sustainable supply chain on the clean energy side, which is what it's going to need to meet 2050 targets.
I'll just add quickly, in terms of the financing side, what Uday mentioned, there's a lot of joint venture just overall. If we look at the pipeline or planned solar and wind and battery projects, just looking at some numbers here from May, as of May, so the top holders based on a weighted ownership. So if the solar project and they have a 40% stake in it is 100 megawatts, we would attribute 40 megawatts to the 40% stake. Out of the top 10 holders here, I think five of them are foreign firms. So I think they have a very active presence in driving a lot of the project development here too on the financing side. So Repsol, EDF, Canada Pension Plan Investment Board, ANGI and Shell. Sometimes it's under them on their own doing a project, but for example, Repsol works a lot with Hecate, that private energy developer that earlier we mentioned, that's a top US private developer. Oftentimes they're in joint venture developing projects together. So they do have quite a significant finance role there.
And I want to be conscious of the time here. We're running a little short. Definitely invite listeners to check out the blog post on msci.com that you worked on together called IRA Boosts US Utilities Plans to Grow Renewables and Storage. I know Uday and John, you mentioned a couple of papers that folks can find at rmi.org, which I invite them to check out as well. But with the little time we have left, what I want to know about, I guess, is reading the blog post, hearing you guys talk, what are you looking at next? Like, what can we expect? What's the next question you're going to work on to try to answer for folks?
What I'm looking at is all of the growing demands from EVs, buildings, and manufacturing. So I said that we need to double the grid, and that was the story we were trying to tell a couple of years ago. And load growth in the growing electricity sector is already a hot topic right now. But in our review of resource plans across the U.S., what we're seeing still only adds up to 20-25% increase in load by 2035. And that's not doubling the grid. And so I think there's a bunch more load coming on from EVs and buildings and electrification of manufacturing. And I'm excited to see more ambitious plans in accelerating clean energy in order to meet that new load.
I think on my end, we've had policy, including IRA, create extraordinary incentives for the electricity sector to decarbonize. But I think what none of us really realized was the extent to which we face challenges in the country to meet load growth and to address affordability across the country, twin challenges that in many ways are heading in opposite directions. But I think there is a real opportunity with all the incentives in place, and I think an opportunity that hasn't adequately been creatively addressed for creative investment and deployment of capital by investors across the country in the electricity sector to meet these challenges. And now is the time for that investment. We've already heard from John, we need to double the size of our grid. And we need to do that while potentially creating enormous value through reshoring of manufacturing and providing the power needed for the next generation of AI load. This is an extraordinary opportunity for the sector in a way that we haven't seen in 100 years. And what I'm really interested in is how we're going to do it in a way that's still equitable, that keeps the electricity system affordable, maybe even lowers costs, and at the same time, meaningfully addresses climate change, which could make all of this not if it's not addressed. That's an enormous challenge, but it's a huge opportunity. It's what I'm excited about.
I'll keep tabs on what I call the four I's: inflation, industrial policy, investments, and innovation. So first two, inflation and industrial policy, I think those are really two big macro factors that set the stage of what's possible and the overall momentum. But they definitely influence the type of investments and innovation that can come from it. So even on the investment side, I think that is important to see, as we talked about the forward-looking indicators, to identify who's showing progress, right? Who's serious about this? But innovation will always create new opportunities and new possibilities and new collaborations. So I'll look forward to how these four factors continue to develop.
And with that, I'll just say thank you all very much, Matthew, John, Uday, for coming on and sharing your insights. As you keep looking into those issues, as your research continues, sincerely hope you'll come back on and speak with us again. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Adam.
That's all for this week. Many thanks from Joe and me to Uday, Matthew, and John, and of course, to all of you for joining us. Next up on the program, MSCI's Chief Research Officer convenes his quarterly panel for a mid-year look at his five key themes for 2024. We'll look at how they've played out over the first 6 months of the year, what surprised our research team, and what investors may look out for as we head into the summer, as well as the second half of the year. Until then, I'm your host, Adam Bass, and this is MSCI Perspective.